Okay, while the computer's getting warmed up, I think it's appropriate to introduce Nancy. Nancy, from you can read from the bio sheet, has quite an extensive bio, but basically she's a principal member of the technical staff, research staff, at Sandia National Laboratories. And she has strong interests and experience on various aspects of terrorism, modeling terrorism-related activities for several parts of the government and governmental departments, such as Department of Energy, DHS, and others. She has an extensive array of experiences regarding serving as science advisor to DOE Assistant Secretary of National Security and Nonproliferation, overseeing a portfolio that included conversion of plutonium reactors in Russia as part of the 1997 U.S.-Russian plutonium production reactor agreement, et cetera. She is also the chair currently of the Santa Fe Institute Working Group on Complexity and Terrorism and works closely with the national and international security communities in general. So once again, I introduce Nancy Hayden.
Thank you. See, I'd like to acknowledge Mike North and that work at Santa Fe Institute and some of my other colleagues here. And also, the work that I'm going to be discussing today has been contributed to by a number of my colleagues at Sandia and academia, and was inspired in part by Dave Hammond, who provided the means to put these ideas together and present them in, at a conference last year in Sweden, where St. Andrews hosted a working group that assessed the state of the art in terrorism research. And they had many distinguished scholars that you would all recognize looking at their respective fields in the social sciences and where they were in contributing to terrorism research. And I was asked to comment on the state of the art of applying those to analysis methods. And a lot of these ideas are drawn from that and some subsequent presentations and contributions from people's reaction to that. But most of all, I'd like to thank Ryan Hoheimer, who in the last hour loaned me his computer because my brand new computer was hanging up every time I tried to transfer this onto my thumb drive, and we wouldn't be looking at anything if it wasn't for Ryan. So thank you very much to Ryan. And also a particular thank you to one particular colleague, John Whitley, who will be joining DITRA, and he'll recognize a lot of his thoughts on wickedness and complexity in this work. And we've been discussing this for a number of years. So the perspective that I'm going to present from is that of an analyst for the intelligence community or an intelligence unit in the military, and how he has to make sense at the end of the day out of his modeling tools. And the mission that he has and the nature of the problem all play into how you put that together. So the analyst's mission, I took this directly out of some material that the intelligence center or intelligence community uses to train analysts. It's to apply in-depth, substantive expertise, all-source information, and tough-minded tradecraft to produce assessments that provide distinctive value added to policy clients' efforts to protect and advance security interests. In doing so, they have to manage the twin perils of substantive and cognitive bias while interpreting complex developments, predicting uncertain outcomes, and engaging in analytic structuring. So that's really what the role of modeling in this perspective should be. The times have been changing in terms of what that means to an analyst, and it's all going in the same direction. In 2004, RAND Corporation ran a series of workshops with the Kent Center, who does train the U.S. intelligence analysts, and looked at what it is that we need and how the needs were changing. And they talked about the need to anticipate threats in highly complex, fast-moving transnational issues, that they need means by which to question judgments and underlying assumptions. You saw these same thoughts reflected in some reviews done by Jane's Intelligence that talk about moving from understanding the order of battle to understanding motivation and intent. And in the latest release of the Quadrennial Defense Review, you see many of the same thoughts that DOD is transforming to meet the new strategic environment, and the shifts include moving from an area of reasonable predictability to one of surprise and uncertainty, to looking at multiple complex challenges, that threats are decentralized network threats, that we need tailored deterrence instead of one-size-fits-all deterrence, that we need to be thinking about shaping the future instead of just responding to crises, and that we need integrated approaches. And these are actually true shifts in the approaches. So when you put that all together, this is the picture actually that we came up with a few years ago at Sandia, and thinking about this with many outside experts in terms of what the way we do analysis now to help decision makers and what's missing. And what we tend to be very good at is the box in the upper left-hand corner that looks at capabilities, that looks at infrastructure, that looks at operations, and can do evaluations based on data and optimization routines as to what should be the next step to get the effect that we want. But what those most often neglected were social, political, psychological, and behavior models of the actual targets of those actions and how they would respond to those, and a way to pull those all together in a unified format, much less even having the knowledge base to feed into any kind of analysis and models of those. So one of the things that I started talking to Dave Hammond about, with that Dittra might want to think about, is how do we even know what's known? You know, and you talk to the experts in the fields, and they complain about, we don't know our unknowns, we don't know our knowns. And that was actually part of the conference that St. Andrews pulled together last year in Sweden. There'll be a book coming out on what do we know, what do we not know, and the different fields that contribute to that. And then given that, what kind of an analysis can we do of the knowns and unknowns? And then that's complemented by our intelligence data, and actually the intelligence gathering should be fed by some of those scenarios about what we know and what we don't know, all of which need to come together to tell intelligence analysts, what are the scenarios I need to be looking for? What are the indications and warnings that tell me that those scenarios are or are not true? How do I communicate those to a decision maker so that they can make sense of it along this whole spectrum of decisions, from peacekeeping, stabilization efforts that we kind of call the green, reducing motivation, all the way to responding to events that have occurred and the warning and military actions in between. An example of how all of this works together is the emphasis in the latest Quadrennial Defense Review on strategic communication and risk management. They talk about moving to risk management in 2001 as a decision-making a framework. And you think about, well, what goes into risk? And DHS has been thinking about this a lot as well. And you know, at the very simplest level, it's understanding the threat, understanding the vulnerability of the targets, and understanding the consequences of actions. But the threat is an emergent property itself of your adversary, and it depends on intent and capabilities. And that's where we're starting to see all this emphasis on motivation and intent, is to understand the dynamic interrelationship between intent and the capabilities that one would acquire. This whole discussion that John was just initiating about what do they think about, what we think about, what they might think about, and how would that drive what they develop in terms of a capability. That's a very complex issue, and how do you understand that? What kind of behavior observables inform an operational understanding of intent? That's a really tough problem, and that's an area that modeling can actually help in. And then finally, what is the scientific basis for these assessments? How solid is our scientific theory in terms of the sociology or the psychology or, you know, whatever it is that you're drawing on in the assessments? How solid is your scientific basis for that modeling effort? So go back to the example of the strategic communication. The QDR in 2001 didn't mention it once. It's mentioned 8 times as a key strategy in 2006. But I kind of question, do they know what that means and how are they going to model it? And there's the two statements we've already heard a couple of times in the conference today. The DOD will integrate strategic communication into U.S. national security policy planning and operations. Victory depends on strategic communication, and it will have to do this to build trusted networks that counter ideological support for terrorism. Who is going to be the target of the strategic communications? How do we know what those targets should be? How do we know what messages need to be delivered to which targets? This is a big area to look at, I think. So I'm presenting this in the paradigm of complexity, and stepping back a little bit, I want to do it. Chick referred to these going to do later in all modeling, and that's come up with a common thought, at least in the rest of my presentation, about what I mean by complexity. A lot of different people define it in different ways, and one of the ways you see it most commonly defined among the whole complexity science community tends to be based on information bits and DJ's back, and so I wish you'd go out because you're much more of an expert on this than I am. So I'm not going to go into the information analysis and the information content area. I'm going to focus what I believe makes more sense in terms of social science and modeling is to use the definitions that have to do with structural complexity and the person that deals with that. Oh, I'm seeing it nod. Yay, good. I'm on the right path with DJ. That Jim Crutchfield has done some more work on that than others that deal with the computational information content end of it. So when you think complexity science, recognize that in the community itself, there's not an agreement about how to measure complexity and how you generate it and how best to analyze it. And I'm drawing on the field that looks at structural complexity, and as you measure structural complexity, you can correlate that to the way we define entities in the social sciences best. And when you do talk about structural complexity, then you can think about it in terms of degrees of orderness in your structures define the degrees of complexity. And when you have no order at all, you have a completely random system, there's very little complexity, you might call that chaotic. This is where DJ might disagree with me because we've had this discussion before. But when you have no order, it's completely random, you tend to have a relatively predictable system in the short term because all outcomes are equally likely. In long term, you don't have that, but in short term, you do. When you have a very ordered system, you have a very predictable system as well. You know the rules of behavior, you know the rules of engagement, and you can deal with that. And it's this area in between where you have some degree of structure, but you have some degree of randomness and ability to respond in unknown ways as a whole structure, that's where you get very complex interactions between your entities and your system, and very simple actions can lead to very surprising and unpredictable behaviors. And that unfortunately, is the realm that most of our national security threats are in. And on top of that, the fact that this is falls in the realm of what's been described as wicked problems. And I'd like to see a show of hands, who is familiar with the term wicked problems? You've heard our talk before. John's heard it. So this is a concept that came out of the early 70s, and it came out of people engaged up at Berkeley, which is where you get wicked complexity all the time anyway, doing social planning. And what they observed was that there are some problems that have these characteristics that define a wicked problem, and I'm very excited to go see Wicked tonight, and we'll see if it's true. But a very short summary of some of the key ones is that wicked problems have characteristics that, first of all, they are really a symptom of another different problem. Every attempt to create a solution changes the problem. Social complexity is a key driver of the problems. And there are many other attributes that there is no right and wrong solution. There's only good and worse, better or worse solutions that you have to... you have no right to be wrong. They tend to be very complex and have high stakes. But one of the keys here is that they cannot be solved in a traditional linear fashion, and they have multiple people looking at them, and every attempt to solve one by one of the players changes the problem itself. And that people tend to solve these, they'll be thinking about it in a linear fashion, and suddenly they'll have that aha moment. They'll have this intuitive sense of what's right, so you'll kind of jump ahead to a solution, you won't be able to explain it to anyone else, and then you go back and try to pull someone else along that's on your team, and they're in a different place in this process, and it becomes very messy and very hard to communicate to decision makers a best solution. And so this whole area of wicked problems is something that was looked at in social planning, and one of the keys to solving those kind of problems is to work in teams, and is to work with explicit assumptions and to work collaboratively in ways that you can make clear to each other what you're doing, but allow this complexity. And that, again, I think leads to good modeling efforts where you can get multiple people looking at multiple perspectives and explain the rationales. So this is a picture of science triumphing when Voltaire discovered the voltmeter, and the question is, can modeling provide the same kind of insights than an aha that the voltmeter did to explain electricity to the masses? We'll have to see. So complexity science does provide some new modeling paradigms for analysis that deal with these problems. And it kind of, in our way of thinking about it, the folks that I've been working with on this, it falls into two categories. One is looking at emergent behaviors, and that's where you get this complexity and surprise that can't be predicted a priori. And it's characterized by having phase transitions and sudden changes in whole-scale behavior, that you get outliers, you get this mutant behavior that can lead to evolution and innovation that you need to keep track of. And another whole area, and so, and that can best be examined through agent-based modeling. And another whole area is the structures that develop through these kinds of interactions and the topologies. And by analysis of those topologies, what can you say about the dynamics of that system, how it might be brittle or how it might be flexible, what rate it might be changing at? So in the science of complex systems, you've got some founding principles. And that, first of all, you have disparate problems that range all the way from very small scale to very large economies and societies. And you can use the same methods across these different scales. They contain a large number of mutually interacting parts. Those parts are, in some sense, purposive. And the one of the beauties of using this paradigm is that you can break down the barriers between looking at physical infrastructures. You go back to that first picture. We have these physical infrastructures. You have capabilities. You have supply chains. You also have these behavioral softer issues on top of that. And you can use the same methods to look across and integrate these multiple different domains. In doing so, this is the whole point of my talk right here. Doing so, the first and most important thing to do is to frame the problem appropriately when you choose the analysis methods and the modeling. And there's really three axes that need to be examined. And one is determining the level of system complexity that you need to be dealing with in order to give the decision maker a robust, best, better, not bad solution to the question that might be at hand in order to make sense of what he's looking at. The second is to understand what is the purpose of your analysis. What's the epistemology? What is the question that's being addressed? Is it merely a need to describe a current situation, a current system, so that you can decide on, what's it going to cost? Describe it so I can define my operational parameters? Or is it something as more in between, going further beyond that, where you have data and you're trying to explain the data, you're trying to explore different options, and maybe even going out to the far right, where you're trying to forecast how different options might play out in the future, and maybe even use the P word of predictive. And there are many, many different reasons to be anywhere along that whole line, and it's very important to know where you're on that line, as well as the system complexity that you're dealing with. And then to think about the time frame, the relevant time frame, not only of the system that you're analyzing, because all these systems have behaviors that have some kind of characteristic time scale to them, but also the time frame that you need to cover for your decision maker. And different methods are appropriate for different time frames. And I've kind of sketched out here notionally some of the different kinds of methods you use for modeling, depending on where you are in this space and the kinds of communities that tend to be in that. You have operational tends to be more on the left-hand side. Strategic analysis tends to be more on the right-hand side, and you have everything in between. So what's the purpose of the analysis, level of complexity, time frame of interest? That needs to be considered in choosing your methods and your models. So again, looking at the structure, there's different topologies. I don't know if Chick will go into this, but I'll show some examples a little bit. Some of you know this, but you have many different implications depending on whether you have a network that's scale-free, that's a hub, that's random. There are many different metrics that can be used to examine those that tell you behaviors. But one of the keys that we tend to forget is it takes some theoretical understanding of what the meaning of those linkages are and the meaning of that structure and topology. You can do a lot of analysis that's kind of mechanistic, but unless you understand the theoretical structure of the meaning, an example is we're looking at data for weeks last summer. Most everyone in here that cares about terrorism probably was when we had the London bombings, and we had all this hypothetical suggestions about what it meant that certain of the individuals had traveled to Pakistan, that certain of the individuals had been meeting in coffee shops, and they'd been going to certain mosques. Well, what is the sociological meaning of those kinds of actions that they were undertaking? Could we really attribute that to that the fact, the idea that there was this, there was a concerted effort and planning going on, or was it just happenstance? Is that something to be expected in a normal social situation that they happen to be in? Those kind of meanings need to be understood before you start going through these analyses. And then also is the dynamics. How stable should you expect networks to be compared to how stable they really are? What is being transmitted across them? How do they grow the fragment? And then what kind of behaviors can emerge across them? And here's just some pictures for some of you who are not deeply involved in network analysis, of the different kinds of networks you can have and the different kinds of linkages. And you can imagine, if you, depending on which one of these networks you're on, and you're worried about a supply chain problem, for instance, or strategic communication, there's different pathways and different nodes that you'd want to target depending on which one of these networks you had and how fast you could expect whatever it is you're trying to transmit across that network to happen. And so this is just an example of what I mean by using networks to do analysis and come up with a decision. This whole idea of small worlds, the 6 degrees of freedom, et cetera, comes from the being in networks on the lower right hand, and it's being challenged now as to whether all scale-free networks really look like that, and that'll be some interesting work that comes out in the future. This is what I want to say here. So on scale-free networks, some of the characteristics, people are thinking that the Al-Qaeda-type terrorist networks are evolving into the scale-free characteristics, and one of those is that the characteristics of those is you get this preferential attachment. So the rich hubs get richer, and that's what the internet's supposed to be like. Google is a big example. It tends to evolve over time to something that's hierarchical with kingpin nodes. It's tolerant to random failure, so you can take out a lot of different nodes and it will reconstruct itself. But it's vulnerable to an informed attack because you can find those kingpin nodes. What is interesting, though, and it's a real caveat right now, is that we don't really know that much yet about these structures. And there's a lot of evidence starting to emerge that not all scale-free networks really have this structure and that they might have a totally different structure that is not vulnerable to informed attack and that can be just as robust to informed attack. And so in our work, we need to really be careful that we're not assuming that we know everything just because the last 3 or 4 years has shown something to be true. Talk about emergence a little bit, and specifically about terrorism. I did a fair review, but it's not a comprehensive review of the terrorism literature in the last 30 years, I would say, and what we are currently presuming we know about terrorism. And one of the key things you'll find is that it's described as an emergent phenomenon at the apex of a pyramid of complex social, physical, institutional systems, and it relies on the sympathetic base. So a key question is, what is it about that base that allows terrorism to emerge from it? And you see within that base simple interactions that lead to very complex behavior where you get the whole is much greater than the sum of its parts. That's a very common term. It was coined by John Holland, and I like to put up this quote that even John Holland himself says, despite its ubiquity and importance, emergence is an enigmatic, recondite topic more often wondered at than analyzed. Recondite, I had to look up. It means it's obtuse, it's very difficult to understand. So even the person that has formulated this concept says, we don't even understand it, and he's one of our Nobel laureates. So, it's just a caveat that we don't get too cocky in what we think we can do with this. That said, it's still a powerful concept. So for those of you who have read Mark Sageman's work and know his book, he really took these thoughts to heart about 4 years ago and started looking at the data that came out on the 911 bombings. And if you read his book, The Understanding Networks, you see these concepts proliferate through his book. He talks about the global Salafi jihad emerged through a process of evolution, that it evolved through the radicalization process consisted of gradual self-selection. This is another key characteristic of complex systems. That the evolution was characterized by a succession of sites which attracted multiple militant networks. This sounds like a scale-free network, you're attracting the kingpin idea. That it had a small world topology, and that it had a spontaneous process of self-organization. And this is all database. So you're seeing these are analogous to the characteristics of complex systems. Again, use that science then to do our modeling. If you want to look at, his work was looking at that tip, where you have terrorism. And then you can also apply this to looking at the base, where you might want to think about things in terms of kind of a radicalized versus a disgruntled base, and how you can use strategic communication to shift that base of support towards an area where it's not as likely to support terrorist activities. And some example questions are, right now Zarqawi is being much more successful in getting support in Jordan and able to stimulate terrorist attacks. Questions about mobilization to action, when do they occur in a radicalized population? The Danish cartoons are an example of that happening, where you had a specific exploitation of this sentiment. How do you shift that base of support so that it will not tip over into that kind of behavior? Those are the kinds of questions you can answer with complex systems analysis. So when you're looking at the degree of structure in your system, you can think about it in turn. If you map it to the way the social sciences think about it, you have individuals, small groups, organizations, institutions, cultures. You have within that subcultures. I know Alinka is working a lot with subcultures. And what are some of the different theoretical bases that can inform those that then get drawn on for your modeling? And this is the area I think Ryan will probably be talking about a little bit, taking one slice through that and how you can model it to fit into the domains. And it's the interdependencies between these that we find to be really powerful when you're doing the modeling. When you're doing specific things that can come out of agent-based models in those domains depend, again, on where you are. And that's why it's so important to frame your analysis to know what questions you're asking. So if you're trying to look at what individuals' agents do, then you think about decision-making models and you go to the cognitive science. If you're looking for the emergence of leaders and terrorist groups, you want to be looking at group dynamics and modeling at that level. If you're trying to think about, you know, strategic communication to the masses, then you think about value transference and the cultural issues. And so parsing the problem, that we're, some of the things we're talking about yesterday need to be parsed along these lines. Switch gears a little bit. Now you've done your analysis. Let's presume you've done your analysis and you've got behavior patterns that make sense, that indicate certain kinds of networks forming, and you need to explain this to a decision maker and predict what is going on here. There's a whole field that is helpful there that tends not to be drawn on as much as it can be, and it's this field of sense making, and it comes from organizational dynamics. And people in the field of organizational dynamics are looking at how organizations move across these levels of complexity, and they go from being fairly known and knowable and operating with things that work to when things stop working, they move into a period of change and innovation, and that's a fairly complex situation, a little bit unpredictable. It could even be chaotic if you take away all order like we did in Iraq. So you're constantly seeing systems moving through these cycles of knowability and unknowability, and they're more or less degrees of order. As you do that, you will see characteristics structures. You'll see characteristics and the kinds of structures and relationships between entities in those individuals. And that can be a way of interpreting the structural topologies you see for sense making to tell you what state your system is in. So, for example, if you've got a system that your linkages, if you observe, you don't really know whether if it's predictable or not. But you see that everyone in the system tends to have strong connections to some hierarchical position, and they don't really interact with each other that much. They're following orders. You can presume you're in a fairly knowable situation, and that system is in a fairly static state of behavior for the time being. If you're in the other quadrant where you don't see a strong leadership and you have a lot of interaction between peer-to-peer level, you can presume that you're going to see complex behaviors. And so this kind of analysis helps you make sense of what you're seeing, and it has a lot of implications on the battlefield in terms of how you probe that system and know more about it. You can then look at the types of behaviors that you observe. They tell you about whether you're moving from one quadrant to another. This becomes a paradigm and a lens by which you can interpret results from agent-based modeling, from topology analysis of linkages and structures. I have a whole paper on set of references in my paper on this if people are interested in learning more about this. That has to do with helping to predict surprise. When you're trying to predict surprise, you have to deal with the fact that your system is evolving or you're not going to have surprise. And the complexity science gives us at least three, there's three that I've come up with, different types of evolution. And these different types of evolution have different time scale characteristics, and they'll have different observables. And so you have the organic evolution, which is your traditional Darwinian one. It's characterized by having a mutant. There's some kind of outlier behavior, some kind of mutation, like you would have in a biological system. And gradually over time, by a series of optimization processes, the other entities, like entities in that system, adopt and kind of mimic those characteristics. That is a diffusive time. It's characterized in technology by some of the work done on diffusion of innovation, where you have one outlier innovation and gradually that diffuses through the system. Another type of evolution is where you have transformative evolution, and that's where all components in the system are experiencing and reacting to the same exogenous forces at the same time. And again, that's a more of a slow, diffusive type process, and the observables you look for that would be things like big panel surveys of social norms. So you're looking at society responding as a whole to some kind of external condition. And then the one where you tend to be when you see these tipping points and phase transitions is what's called epochal evolution. And some people correlate it to punctuated equilibrium. And I'm not sure this is the same thing. But it's when you get both of these combined, where you have a mutant or an outlier or an innovator out there by themselves suddenly converging with this whole-scale transformation in a way that causes a tipping point, or you get this phase transition. And the Danish cartoons is a prime example of that. You had these clerics in the Netherlands that they were fringe elements. They were not getting support from their community. They were not getting support from their government. They were dissatisfied, kind of extreme radicals. And they moved outside of their system and exploited this dissatisfaction with the West and a very large targeted Muslim community elsewhere to bring them to their state of being and to their position. And that's what this whole idea of epochal evolution is like. It's when you have a basin, a whole system is in one, what's called a basin, and in terms of physical entropy characteristics, and you have another whole system in another basin, and one entity kind of discovers a pathway to move one to the other. It's kind of like going to warp speed on Star Trek or something of this nature. That is where you have very rapid and sudden change, and those are the kinds of observables that are looking for that situation are very different than when you have organic or transformative. So agent-based modeling combined with network analysis can look at these kind of situations. Cognitive modeling can look at those individual outliers and how they evolve, and so you can combine those two. Ideological trend analysis, again, becomes something important to look at in terms of the overall transformative processes. And all of these require data. You need much more focus to be able to look at these phase transitions and tipping points on those bases of support. We don't have the kind of data we need that. And we need much better understanding of feedback between the action of one player and the responses of the interacting entities. And in particular, states, the United States actions that are intended to elicit an action from an adversary or a community of support, monitoring that and observing that and then seeing how that reaction is and feeds back into the system. We don't tend to do that very well in our data gathering on the political strategic arena. Just a comment on last year I did a survey of how the kinds of tools from complexity science are being used in predicting terrorism or terrorism analysis. And I did a search, social science citation index, just for 1 year on the terms that had to do with agent-based modeling and social network analysis. We got hundreds of terms. And then I threw in the word terrorism, and I got 4. So this is, at least within the peer-reviewed literature, that the methods have not been used and applied as much as they can to this kind of a problem. And there's a lot of, and this is part of my message last year in Sweden, there's a lot of room to bring the two communities together, which is what JTAC is all about, is trying to bring that social science community together with this modeling-type community. That the places that you do see a lot of application are in supply chain. Where's Mike? You've done a lot of that work. The business supply chain, information sciences, economic type models. You just don't see it in a lot of national strategic applications, national security applications. One of the reasons is because, my hypothesis is because of the kinds of knowledge that's required. We don't tend to gather the kind of knowledge that's required in our national security considerations that you have in business applications or manufacturing applications. And this is just a sketch of the full list that's required. And just in terrorists itself, we've been talking about, the relational dynamics, worldview, the whole question of culture and above that, psychology. So, Oh, yes, that's just a 1 year literature search of peer reviewed articles. My statement is it's not being utilized by the academic social science research community that can provide that knowledge base to that problem. It's not to say it's not being used by intelligence community. In fact, DOD. No. It's not to say that at all. The disconnect I see is, as I said early on, that really solid application needs to be based on solid academic theoretical foundations. And so there's a gulf that needs to be bridged now. I'm not saying it's, you know, it's unbridgeable. It doesn't have some people working on it. But there's a lot of room for improvement to move the academic community that's publishing, that's doing peer-reviewed work, to apply and think about problems in the national security domain to raise the bar, to raise the standard. And again, that's what I think JTAC is really about, is trying to bring those communities together. Yeah, yeah. It's not at all to say that's not being done. It's just not, yeah, right, right, right. No, exactly. Thank you. If anybody missed that, they find that now. So. No, agreed, exactly. But it's being done in absentia of a large following of peer-reviewed academics. So again, the same picture we saw before, but a different bottom line in the corner here. The purpose of thinking about things from complexity perspective is not to add complexity and complication to the problem. The real purpose in using these methods is to use them to reduce the unnecessary complexity that will allow you to have clarity and insight to make sense. So that should be the bottom line purpose when we use this. And the knowledge that's fed into that helps understand what's unnecessary to consider for the particular behavior in question you have. And that's why framing is so important. At the end of the day, the analyst has to go to somebody above him and say, what is the story and what do I do about it? And that's the science of sense-making. It's not the science of evaluating data anymore. It's the science of trying to make sense of what you see. It's interpretive. And you need as many perspectives as you can. You need a lot of judgment. You need alternative hypotheses. You need dynamic analysis. You need learning among multiple people. You need all of this to be very explicit so you can consider it and talk about it and think about what you're doing. And that's what modeling, in my mind, provides. So that's the end of the story. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.